The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
This is The Money Show. Good evening. I am Bruce Whitfield. Andy Rice joins us in an hour's time. We're going to talk to him about his heroes and zeros. Also, a little bit of pressure being brought to bear on some corporates who've not been treating you with the respect that you deserve. So Andy's been getting very cross with them on the radio, and they've listened, and they've made some small corrections to the way in which they do they behave. And so that is excellent to see as well. Kevin Ling standing by. We'll chat to him. He is the chief economist at Stanlib Asset Management. Moody's has been in town, and there have been some crucial developments with Moody's. They're basically saying that there's no imminent requirement for a ratings downgrade, which is a piece of good news. Also, lots of things coming up in the next couple of weeks that we need to tick the boxes on and get right. We're making good progress. We are. Wayne McCurry with our market commentary tonight. We'll look at what Jack Ma's achieved in 20 years, an extraordinary achievement in building Alibaba. We'll talk to the guy who founded a business called 4X, and courtesy of this radio station and the attention that he got on this radio station, managed to raise a lot of money in the first round of funding that he sought in 2015. Plus, later on, Richard Rushton, the chief executive of Distell. We're talking the South African liquor trade, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the branding of South African booze. All of that tonight on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Although it downgraded growth expectations for 2019, Moody's today is saying there's just a low likelihood of a downgrade to South Africa's credit rating. It also expects government debt to stabilize. Now, if we lose our investment grade from Moody's, we lose our place in the investment grade club of government bonds. It's the Citigroup World Government Bond Index, and that would make it more expensive to us to borrow internationally. Listening to that is Kevin Lings, chief economist at Stanlib, who joins us on the line from Johannesburg this evening. It's quite optimistic, actually, of Moody's to say that there are no plans for a downgrade, Kevin Lings. That's really welcome, considering we think, I think on a daily basis, that we're probably due one.
Evening, Bruce. I would agree with that. Look, Moody's has generally been fairly positive about South Africa's economy, despite the deterioration. And obviously, they've had many opportunities to move South Africa's credit rating to below investment grade. They have, over time, obviously moved the rating lower. In 2009, we were an A-rated country by Moody's, so we've moved down, and now we're at one notch above the investment grade. And clearly the deterioration in the last, say, 2 years has become much more noticeable, and Standard & Poor's and Fitch both took us to below investment grade. And so there should be a nervousness that Moody's will follow suit. When Moody's assesses that, though, there are a couple of things that stand out. The one is, they constantly remind us that they are assessing South Africa relative to other emerging markets. And when they look around the world, the deterioration in South Africa is actually not as stark or not as sharp as what you've seen in other countries. And so on a relative basis, South Africa doesn't represent the type of risk that they've seen in many other countries. The second thing, and they pointed that out in their conference, their meeting today, was that they do see that the government is implementing the right sort of reforms, or talking about the right types of reforms. Obviously, they are saying that government needs to go from talking about the right sort of reforms into implementing it. So that's the negative. There isn't enough implementation of policy change. But I guess they do buy into the notion that government is trying to stabilize government finances, etc., and put South Africa on a better path. And the question is, will they still give us this time? They're going to review us again towards the end of the year, I think around the 1st of November. It is possible that we're still on investment. In fact, I would expect that by the end of the year, we remain on investment grade from Moody's. But it is possible that they take the outlook statement, which is currently stable, from stable to negative, to indicate that, yes, there has been deterioration, and that if we don't see an improvement, then during the course of next year, we could well be downgraded to below investment grade. So I think there have been warnings. I think they've been quite lenient. They clearly are willing to tolerate further leniency, but that's not endless. And so we've got to start to implement the policy changes we keep talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure they may have been moved by the fact that Tito Mboweni did post his plan about 2.5 weeks ago now. And today we see the ANC caucus in Parliament tentatively supporting Tito Mboweni's recovery plan. And we're hearing the right noises, at least after some initial sort of backlash and rambunctiousness. Things are calming down a little, at least on the policy front.
I think so. I think that the Minister of Finance's plan, obviously it wasn't strictly in accordance with ANC process in terms of how it was released, but I think nevertheless it's a sensible plan. It's very practical in nature. It's stuff that I think can be implemented within a fairly short period of time. It's also stuff that I think would make a difference to confidence and ultimately to growth. So for me, it's a good idea. It's a good set of policy ideas. Again, the criticism or the concern would be, are we able to implement that? Have we got the institutional capacity to take that and make that real? But it's a clear indication that government is determined to try and at least stabilize the fiscal position. It is determined to restructure Eskom and get that headache solved. And it is determined to try and ultimately lift the growth rate and employment.
Yeah, I mean, Eskom is the crucial one. I saw Jabu Mabuza saying today that Eskom cannot exist without government support. And I suppose it's the shape of that support and the scale of that support that matters from an investor point of view.
So that's 100% right. Obviously, Moody's has said that whatever debt Eskom has is in effect government debt. You can't differentiate the two. And so in terms of their calculations, they've already taken Eskom's debt and included in the calculation on government's debt, just to indicate that government is ultimately responsible for this, and I guess responsible actually for most of the SOE debt. What needs to happen is that they've got to find a way to take a big portion of Eskom's debt off their balance sheet, probably put that in the hands of government, let government service that debt, and then free up Eskom's balance sheet to be managed much better. And that can work as long as you're improving the operational effectiveness or efficiency of Eskom so that it doesn't just get itself back into debt. Mm. So there's a lot that has to go on and be thought about regarding Eskom restructuring. From what I understand, that is underway, and we should be hearing more definitive plans about the Eskom unbundling during the course of this month. I suspect that is being discussed with Moody's. In other words, that the Minister of Public Enterprises, Minister of Finance, is having a discussion with Moody's to say, this is what we're thinking around Eskom. Would this be an acceptable restructuring, and would that allow us to retain our investment grade rating? So I don't think that the Eskom restructuring will be done in isolation. There are many moving parts to it. And Moody's themselves today were saying, this is a complex issue. It's not as if you can suddenly solve it. It's an iterative process. There's a negotiation. But as long as you're moving in the right direction, then hopefully they'll remain, give us the investment grade.
That is the critical point. I mean, they've always said we need to be showing our intent and ability and capability to move that way. And there will be no bigger test, probably, than the medium-term budget policy statement, which is going to be scrutinized and dissected and analyzed and torn to pieces, probably like no other speech of its kind in recent times.
I would agree. So that's on the 23rd of October, I think. And to me, that's going to be the most critical medium-term budget we've had. Obviously, we say those sorts of things every time there's a budget, but I think this is especially critical because it's going to demonstrate government's willingness to show clear fiscal discipline on a three-year basis. The tax revenue is drying up. We know that we're going to have a tax revenue shortfall, probably in the order of $50 billion at this stage. The Minister of Finance can't simply assume that away. He's going to have to factor that in, and he's going to have to show how government is adjusting the expenditure to meet this lower tax revenue. And then on top of that, he's going to have to talk about things like national health insurance, how that be factored into the budget. He's going to have to talk about the SOE's financing and the restructuring of Eskom, and how is that going to cost the government? Because ultimately, he's setting a three-year budget, and there's a lot that he's got to distill into those 3 years. So I think this medium-term budget next month will tell us a lot about the intention within government to do the right thing, to do discipline, to be disciplined. And obviously, Moody's will have that information before they make their decision on the 1st of November.
We need clarity on industrial policy. We'd like to see interest rates coming down just a little bit. And, of course, critically, the president, he doesn't take no for an answer. He did an investment summit last year. It was all going swimmingly till we ran out of electricity in January. He's having another investment summit come November. He's nothing if not tenacious when it comes to trying to convince foreigners to part with their money.
So if you go back to 2018, the president set this benchmark of trying to raise $100 billion locally and internationally to be invested in South Africa over a five-year period. He had the first investment summit last year. It was a resounding success at the time, and there was more or less about $20 billion worth of investment pledged, mostly from the private sector. So I attended the conference. I certainly thought it came across really well. It was patriotic. It ticked all the boxes. And then, as you say, very soon after that, we ran out of electricity, and it tends to undermine that investment initiative. The president said that they're going to repeat this, and so they're going to repeat it again this year, and it's in November, around about the 5th, 6th, 7th of November. And it's again going to focus attention on private sector investment. And that $100 billion target remains in place. What I'm hoping from that summit is, firstly, that they explain why there's been a lack of fixed investment. In other words, own up to the criticism. Where have we gone wrong? What's caused this lack of investment? And secondly, explain what it is that we're going to do that's going to inspire more private sector investment. And that includes industrial policy. Now, Ebrahim Patel, who's the Minister of Trade and Industry now, the unified department, he is talking about releasing his plans around the revitalization of South African manufacturing. That should happen this month. And that obviously initially is going to have a focus on clothing and textiles, but I think it's going to broaden out from that. And so we're going to look at that content and say, is that a policy framework for industrial policy that business can get behind and start to invest? If it is, then it makes for a good investment summit in November, because it would be an encouraging policy. So it's going to be a clear test for the new Minister of Trade and Industry. Can he entice business behind his policy to start to invest more actively?
Is it my imagination? Are you feeling a little bit more upbeat this week than perhaps you were a month or two ago?
Well, last week I thought it was a dreadful week for the country as a whole. It does feel a little bit better this week. I think we've reacted to some of the events last week, and I think we're reacting still. I thought that the policy announcements from the Minister of Finance, or the policy document, was a good step in the right direction. I do think there's a concerted effort to solve Eskom. I do think there's an intention to try to keep the credit rating. I think people are trying to move the economy in the right place. By mean people, I mean senior government officials. Obviously, other things, the global backdrop is not particularly helpful, etc. But I do sense that we've got some areas we can focus on, and hopefully we get some positive announcements literally over the next couple of weeks that take us into next year, where we start on a better base and we can realistically expect an improved growth outlook.
Yeah, at least we're not playing with matches in the lounge anymore. I mean, it's like, you know, at one stage we were opening tins of petrol in the lounge and then playing flicking matches about the place. We've stopped doing that. You know,
I think we have, partly because it never really helped, and partly because I think that there's a recognition that this is everybody's problem, and that we can't just sit back and wait for this idly to change. I think we've seen business being much more vocal in urging government to lift growth. I think that's a good thing. I think we understand that Eskom is not a problem you can just keep delaying and delaying inevitably. So I think there's a realization that time is not on our sides, and we've got to start to act more decisively. I think that's the message going back to government. And so we argue that by the time we get to the middle of November, we should be in better shape, and that many of these decisions, the credit rating, the medium-term budget, the investment summit, all of that will be behind us. And hopefully the net of that is that we're in better space for 2020.
Kevin Lings, thank you very much indeed. Kevin Lings is the chief economist at StanLib. Wayne McCurry.
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. I was wondering where you were.
No, I'm
you're hiding under the desk.
No.
Markets aren't that scary, Wayne. You can come out. It's okay.
Okay, thanks, Bruce.
Tell us about markets. Tell us what your reading was of markets today.
Well, the market was actually reasonably good today. I mean, the all share, it was down, but certainly the financials and some of the South African orientated shares, and the Rand definitely took a bit of positive news from the Moody's statement that there's no imminent downgrade. And in fact, the exact words, as you well know, was there's a low possibility of a downgrade to junk status as things stand now, because they think that the government is going to consolidate their debt. And obviously, they've been talking to a lot, or more correctly, the government, a lot of government people have been talking to them.
I mean, it's really encouraging to see, isn't it? Because, I mean, South African public perception is government's not in control. There's no control. We're headed down the slippery slope to an inevitable downgrade. That's what the market believes. You talk to anybody in financial markets, present company excluded, because I saw you tweeting positively this morning. But up until this morning, everyone was kind of like, yeah, we're definitely headed for a downgrade next year. There's no question. There is no way we can hold on to our investment grade rating. Suddenly that's turned a bit.
Well, despite the fact that, you know, I'm more optimistic and pessimistic, I also thought junk status was inevitable. I just thought it was probably already priced in. So this also came as a positive surprise to me that it's not a foregone conclusion that we're going to go junk status. I mean, make no mistake, unless we carry on down this path and we see more and more meaningful action, I mean, we will eventually go junk status. And unless we can turn the ship, now I think the ship, the bow is starting to just ease across, but it's a 300,000-ton bulk carrier, you know, it takes a long time to turn it.
Yeah.
You know, unless we can turn it, we will ultimately go junk status, and then one level down and then another level down, and then the next thing we'll be knocking on the IMF's door. And so I have full confidence that we will turn the ship, but we must understand you've got to actually turn the ship, because it's only going one way now, and we must be very careful about that. And of course, I mean, as we spoke about the other day as well, read Adrian Gore's article. You mean South Africa's love to be negative about the outlook that we have for the country, and it's always going to the dogs. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's our perpetual narrative, and it's really encouraging to see that the rest of the world sees us differently to ourselves, which is nice to see. Today, not too much corporate news doing the rounds, but some really interesting moves in terms of the sentiment towards markets. Moody's definitely sort of teed us up. The Rand moved to its best levels in a month. Commodity prices pulled back quite sharply. How much of what is happening in our market is local versus international? I mean, just this evening in the last half hour, John Bolton getting fired has seen a dollar drop off the oil price and the dollar weaken.
Yeah, look, I mean, overseas is still pick a number. 70% of what happens in our market is dependent on what's overseas, because that's not just the significant proportion of our companies whose businesses are international businesses. It's also the sentiment towards emerging markets, and I hate the term, but risk on versus risk off, and how the US is feeling, and is the President Trump tweeting, and all of these things is a massive effect on our market. Locals' circumstances don't influence the market that much. But certainly when you take some of the retailers and probably all of the banks, there obviously it's local factors that have more of an influence on those particular sectors.
Yeah, I mean, is it possible to start? I mean, you've been optimistic for some time and telling us, look, I mean, while you've not been optimistic, you've not been pessimistic, saying these things do take time and these things will pick up. But is this the time to start nibbling, to start looking more closely at opportunities in South Africa?
You know, Bruce, I would think so. And I mean, we've spoken about this on so many occasions. The bottom line is, do you think the future is better or worse? It doesn't have to be good. It must just be better than what we have experienced. If that is the case, some of these shares, the retailers, the food retailers, the banks, some other South African orientated shares are truly cheap if you believe that scenario.
Wayne McCurry, he is with FNB Wealth and Investments this evening on The Money Show.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Welcome to The Money Show. See, the liquidators of VBS Mutual Bank have served papers on the former president, Jacob Zuma. Now, this is them demanding repayment of a mortgage loan. We should have known at the time that VBS Mutual Bank gave an octogenarian, almost an octogenarian, a massive loan on a property that's not in his name. Nkandla is not in his name, but he had to pay for the non-security upgrades. Thuli Madonsela said, pay back the money. And so eventually he agreed, and he had to take out a loan from BBS Mutual Bank. They were the only guys at that point who prepared to lend an old guy with job prospects that weren't guaranteed a vast amount of money. Now, it does seem like he may have fallen behind on his payments, because that's the assertion from the liquidators of VBS Mutual Bank, saying that they will ask the court to attach his Nkandla property to recoup the money. It was a massive controversy at the time as to who actually owned the property, whether or not this was something, an asset that a bank would be able to seize in the event of non-payment. Certainly the liquidators of VBS Mutual Bank exploring the legal options on that, which is an interesting development. On the next Money Show, join me for the chief executive of Summer Place Equity Partners, Modulo Mofolo. They're one of the eight funds benefiting from the SASME fund. We've also got Business Unusual with Colin Cullis, looking at modern business workplaces, and Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, looking into the challenge for companies when it comes to responding to consumer gripes or queries, especially on social media platforms like Twitter. Can you ever win? Doesn't seem like it. We'll hear from Wendy.
702
SMS Bruce on 31702.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. It is 16 minutes to 7. The story, that's a weird story out of the SABC today, saying that there's prima facie evidence that there was tampering, that there was sabotage with the diabolical broadcast of Cyril Ramaphosa's speech last Thursday night. Cyril Ramaphosa addressed the nation, or at least was intending to do so, live at 6 o'clock, or as live, a recorded statement. And somehow, the statement that got onto television that we carried, courtesy of the SABC on Thursday night, had a mistake. And it was one of those things that happens. It happens all the time in recorded television where somebody makes a fluff and then you go, oh, terribly sorry, I'll try that again. And you pick up and you start from the top. There's nothing embarrassing about it. It was just one of those things. What was embarrassing was the fact that this was something that was recorded and the SABC should have done considerably better and shouldn't have hung the president out to dry. Now, they are asserting this 5 days later that three of those people involved in the production activities have been implicated in sabotage. And a statement released on Tuesday, the public broadcaster said those involved in production activities were all warned in advance that they should disregard the rehearsal clip. The SABC now has strong prima facie evidence indicating the broadcast of the incorrect clip was well considered and coordinated act of sabotage to bring the SABC and consequently the president into disrepute. That's a very serious allegation. Sure, it's just not an old-fashioned mess-up. Seems very likely that was possible. One of the best presentations I've ever seen at Davos was by Jack Ma. He's witty, he's quick, he's funny, he's charming, he's clever, he's lots of things. He's a great communicator, the founder of the online marketplace Alibaba. The former English teacher was rejected 10 times by Harvard, but it taught him a particular level of resilience when he went into business for himself. And over 20 years, built a $460 billion enterprise. He's only 55, and tonight is his retirement party for him and 80,000 of his closest friends in a massive stadium in the city where he was sharing a flat at the time that he started Alibaba. Toby Shapshak, publisher at Stuff Magazine, is a fan. It's a huge day, I suppose, for Alibaba and one of the greatest Chinese startups of our generation, Toby Shapshak.
Indeed, Bruce. I mean, it's quite significant what he has been able to build, which is often called Amazon's the answer to Amazon in Asia. It's Asia's most valuable listed company. He is Asia's richest man. It really is just the most remarkable kind of rags to riches story, a true such story. And he deserves all the credit. Of course, he's along the way done a bunch of other noteworthy things. He started Alipay, which is now one of the largest payment systems in China, along with WeChat, and has become Alibaba has become the bedrock of lots of China's e-commerce success. It's a marketplace that allows people to sell things directly in it, and it has, for people who are familiar with Amazon, it has it has a very similar kind of look and feel, and it's fantastic. I use a similar service called AliExpress that you can buy things from China directly, small amounts, small things, and they get sent to it is the American dream, which is what Amazon represents, but it's the Asian dream of being able to buy and sell. And of course, the number of people along the way that Alibaba has made rich is quite fantastic. You know, Jack Ma was here last year, and he told this little story about how someone came up to him in a restaurant and bought him dinner and said, "Thanks to you, I've been able to, have a very successful life and do a lot of things." So, you know, he thought that was a great thank you from people. I mean, it's ordinary people who benefit the most from Alibaba, isn't it?
Well, from any investment, from any growth of any company, people get employed, people invest, people take risk, people put money on the table, and if you succeed and they ride in your coattails, they should be happy. Now, his successor is a really interesting guy. He's an accountant. He's apparently very softly spoken. And it must be the equivalent of Tim Cook taking over from Steve Jobs for this poor guy to be taking over from the mighty Jack Ma, because Jack Ma's a larger-than-life character too.
Well, I have to agree, and it's an analogy that's been made often. It is the less flamboyant of the two taking over. Certainly, I mean, it's I suppose the dilemma that someone's going to have when they take over from the great Bruce Whitfield. You know,
don't speak too soon. Don't speak too soon. But in the real world of Jack Ma and his successor, what did Jack Ma leave behind? I mean, at 55. He's got many, many years ahead of him, potentially. What sort of legacy does he leave in the global internet trade?
Interestingly, he has a foundation for teaching entrepreneurs, and he does something with UNCTAD. And they are trying to do entrepreneurship training in Africa, and he does that kind of thing. They select young people, they go back to his hometown, and they get shown how Alibaba did it, and it's incredibly inspirational and aspirational for a lot of people, and they teach young entrepreneurs how to do what Jack Ma did, which is nothing short of fucking amazing.
I beg your pardon. Thank you, Toby Shapshak. Yes, Toby Shapshak. You can apologize later. Publisher at Stuff Magazine, Toby Shapshak. He's a renegade. On his behalf, I apologize to your delicate and sensitive ears.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Welcome to The Money Show. And if you've ever traveled, you know that invariably you return home with coins and low-value banknotes, and they're not really worth cashing in anywhere because you're going to pay massive fees. Well, imagine being able to get rid of the inevitable shrapnel at an affordable rate. And we told you a couple of years ago about a company called 4X, a UK startup created by a group of South Africans with an overwhelmingly South African board. Oliver Du Toit is on the line to us from Kent in England, the founder of 4X. You guys have been flying since 2015, Oliver.
We have, and successfully fighting our way as ex-South Africans in a financial capital of the world.
I mean, what have you got? 67 locations now, these machines. They're great big yellow cash-guzzling machines. How do they work?
Well, essentially, you take any coin or note, and unmixed, you pour it onto a conveyor belt on the shelf of the kiosk, and it converts that coin or note into a cash deposit. So you can you put it in your coins, and you receive out pounds, euros, or dollars. So that's selectable from the front screen.
So I could chuck in U.S. cents, euros, I could chuck in a 5-euro coin, I could chuck in a 5-rand coin, and the machine would be able to calculate all at once what the pound value of those coins was.
You could be putting in a Botswana puller, and we accept that too.
I mean, it's astonishing the success that you've had. I mean, is it just in the UK at this stage? I see you've got international expansion plans, but in a place where currency is as freely traded as the UK, it's proved a good testing ground for you.
It is a good testing ground, and we in primary locations in London and the surrounding areas, because of the high footfall and the visitors traveling to and fro from the continent. So that's where primarily we want to build down the concept and Now we're now branching out north and south to greater UK with the kiosks, and at the end of the summer we'll have 80 kiosks operating in England.
I mean, you're looking for funding. You have raised money before. My former colleague John Robbie had a conversation with you a couple of years ago, and by all accounts that was a fairly good catalyst for the first round of funding that you got.
Bruce, it was the make or break of for us. John Robbie put us on his show, and we were broadcast to the entire South African population on the breakfast show. And at that time, we were going for the Pitch to Rich presentation and competition. And the South Africans supported us in every turn. And we got it over the line wholly and solely because of the support we were getting from the South African guys, just supporting us with this new concept in the UK.
I mean, have you got greater attention now in the UK market? Do you still need the sort of local support, or are you finding funders a little bit more interested in what you've got to offer?
We are, but we, you know, there's always, as we expand, a need for funding as we grow, and we're growing at an exponential rate. So we need to bed down as quickly as possible the UK, and then we branch further afield.
Do we ever get to see one of your machines in South Africa, or foreign exchange rules just too complicated to allow it?
No, we intend to go to South Africa and all the neighbouring countries in possibly 2 to 3 years' time. Obviously, the regulations are quite stringent. In fact, we are in negotiations with several parties in South Africa at present with a mind to develop and manufacture in that region and also deploy.
My goodness me. Oliver de Toey, we look forward to seeing them. The founder of 4X on the line to us from Kent in the United Kingdom this evening. Oliver de Toey has, with a group of South Africans, created these machines, the 4X machines, obviously a play on the word forex, and is looking to expand and grow and possibly build in this country. Some of you would have helped him do that a couple of years ago. Now going for a second round of funding, looking for a couple of million more rand in order to grow his business. Oliver de Toey on the line to us from the UK.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Andy Rice standing by, our branding and advertising expert, with the ever popular Heroes and Zeros feature. Chat to him about that this evening. He's got some fabulous ones for you this evening, including an update from Checkers. Gave them a zero a couple of weeks ago. They seem to be taking him seriously, which is good. Chris Bishop with our Africa Business Report. He is the head of programming and author of Africa's Billionaires at CNBC Africa. We'll talk to him in just a bit. And then Richard Rushton is the CEO of Distell. And Distell is a massive South African liquor producer. They make wine, they do produce spirits as well. I mean, if you want, Autumn Harvest and Paul Perlet come from the same from the same producer. The J.C. LaRue and Pongratz, Durbanville Hills, Niederberg, and Old Brown Sherry, Baines Mountain Whiskey, and Buna Havin come from the same family too, as do Hunters and Savannah. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the phenomenon of Amarula and the ready-to-drink market as well. The South African liquor trade is booming, but not as much as it could be. I thought we drank more when we were depressed. It turns around we seem to drink more when we're happy, and we haven't been happy for a long time. So sales of its products in Africa outside of South Africa have been pretty important to the progress of Distell. So that's all coming up in the next hour.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Andy Rice, our branding and advertising expert with Heroes and Zeros this evening. Before we get there, Andy Rice, Pick n Pay has gone chicken.
Yeah, they seem to have dug themselves a bit of a hole and then jumped into it. If you were deciding to run a new advertising campaign based around sort of cultural, multilingual jokes, and you were doing it in the chicken category, I think you might feel that someone would let you know that perhaps you're getting into Nando's territory, both with the content and with the style. And that's what Pick n Pay have done. And They went in rather bluntly with their advertising. I'm not going to fall into the same trap myself by trying to communicate the isiZulu and the isiXhosa original, but suffice it to say that the social media platforms lit up, and Pick and Pay were criticised, I think quite rightly, and quite friendlily as well, if there's such a word.
What all the fuss was about, Andy Rice. Let's get a sense of what the fuss was about, and then we can talk about out-Nandosing Nandos in a moment.
Fried chicken. When it's this tasty, we call it Inkuku.
Inkuku's ready.
This Inkuku is so juicy. Girls, get in on this Inkuku action.
This Inkuku is fire.
It made my skin crawl the first time. My skin's still crawling. And Nando's, of course, went, oh, excellent. There's an opportunity. And they sideswiped the campaign.
Well, they were very restrained and probably all the more powerful because of that, because all they simply did was put in a little response on Twitter that said, in effect, that's awkward. And I think it revealed that they are more in charge of cultural communication than their competitors at Pick and Pay.
Yeah. That one fell flat, I'm afraid. Tell me about Checkers. I mean, you had a go at Checkers a couple of weeks ago because they have these magnificent advertising spreads and then say, you can get this thing and it's great and it's awesome. Look at this great price, except in these places. If you live in Rustenburg and other places, well, bad luck for you.
Yep, Bruce, that's right. I mean, they run these, particularly on radio, they run these specials spots, which sound very enticing indeed, unless, of course, you live in either Mafeking or Lichtenberg, because every commercial ended excluding, bluntly, Mafeking and Lichtenberg. And I grumbled and said that there should be a consumer uprising in these towns, not entirely seriously. And to my delight, I've just heard recently a very similar sort of format of Checkers advertising their specials for the week. But at the end, instead of just bluntly saying excluding these towns, it says different but equally attractive deals available at Lichtenberg and Mafeking. And I wonder whether the power of the money show hasn't reached the depths of Northwest Province.
It's the power of the rice. It's the power of the rice, I tell you. Tell me about your hero this week.
Well, one of the big challenges that everybody in advertising faces in this new digital world is that we're all time-starved enough already, and here is advertising trying to steal a bit more of what's left. So there's a kind of useful golden rule that I think advertising people should stick to, which is stop interrupting the thing that I'm interested in and start being what I'm interested in. And I think that's a very useful warning that you can get too carried away with looking for every last little niche where you can stick an advertisement and find it quite obtrusive if you're on the receiving end of the message. And I get lots of emails from people saying, I've invented the most amazing new advertising medium, and nearly always they're flawed simply because they end up being further intrusive rather than helpful. I was reminded of a lesson that people who join the Navy are quickly taught, which is how to survive in the Navy. If it moves, salute it. If it doesn't, paint it. Now, I think the same thing applies to advertising. If it moves, salute it by all means. But if it doesn't, slap an ad on it. And we find ourselves being advertised to in everything from urinals to luggage carousels to skywriting and back to urinals again. And I really don't quite know how many of those are long-term media that will survive. But there's a new one that crossed my desk this last week. And I think it's perhaps got a bit more chance because it's a medium that reaches its audience in a very relaxed and peaceful and friendly environment, because it's actually branded pool tables. Now, did you know that pool is considered in some surveys the number one sport, if you can call it that, in the world in terms of participation? Well, apparently it is. And now a local company, Union Billiards, have got the nous to put together an advertising opportunity on a proportion of the 50,000 coin-operated tables that exist in South African townships alone. And they're using a new
form of printing called sublimated printing, which puts a full-color, super high-resolution image onto the felt itself, in fact, replacing the felt. So the entire playing surface of the table is one big ad. And I think if you're in the liquor business or the transport business or mainstream foods, it might be just a nice way to promote your brand in, as I say, an easygoing and relaxed environment with all those great games of pool you play over weekends.
Yeah, but would you put your brand on a dartboard, I wonder, Andy Rice? It's a kind of different proposition, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think it'd be interesting to do a research study to take a tavern somewhere and brand equally the dartboard and the pool table and see which one came off better.
I don't know. I think a Durex advert and a dartboard would be hilarious, but that's just me. And then, you've got me on this one, I'm afraid. I'm completely, completely in agreement with your zero. Your zero is one of the most disgraceful, intrusive, vulgar forms of marketing that exist in our world today.
Well, thank heavens for an app that I use, apparently a bit controversially, called Truecaller. This Truecaller scans its database and lets you know whether an incoming call, which is just a number on your screen, is in fact spam or not. And it's an invaluable defense against the sort of mindless cold calling of myriad telemarketing companies and their clients. You know, I think you can understand perhaps if you're a local business in a local community, maybe there's an option to do some marketing over the phone. But really, those big corporates who use it on a huge scale can afford other mass media and ought to, really. And I know they'll say that kind of 1% of it is all they need for the calls to work, but I think they should be reminding themselves that they could be offending 99 people out of 100. I get beeps in the middle of the night from my cell phone, even though it's on quiet, and I find in the morning it's a message about whatever. And who are the worst culprits? Well, I think it's the financial services businesses. Around the election, of course, it was the DA. And the telecoms companies seem to be the most frequent culprits. So I'm going to actually award it my zero this week to one of the bigger culprits from the telecoms arena, because they're the ones who seem to pester me the most, and that's Telkom Fiber. And I'm giving it to them not just because of the frequency of their calls, but even more so because they ought to know that we've already got fiber and they're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, and it's, again, the unsolicited mobile calls is one thing. A human being phones you and you answer it by accident because you should know better by now. And you can say, please, will you just take me off your mailing lists and go away and don't phone me again. And I find that works pretty effectively. But it's when you get the recorded calls, when you get the tape recorder, which says to you, hello, you can buy this insurance product because you need insurance. I mean, it is so intrusive because there's nobody to ask please to shut up. So what I did the other day was I accepted that I would get the call center to phone me. But it took them about 6 or 7 days, by which time I'd forgotten that I'd actually asked that they phone me. And when they did, I said, this is not aimed at you. This is aimed at your chief executive. Could you just hold on a second, please? And she said, certainly. So I did a little bit of research as to who the company chief executive was. And I said, this is to you, Mr. Jones, or whatever his name was. And I gave him 90 seconds of my most fruity response that I could within, I hope, the cold confines of the law, to express my displeasure at their strategy. And I think more of us should do that, frankly.
I think so. I mean, my anger when I get a call from a human being is only slightly tempered by the fact that being what they call an outbound call operator, the person who makes the calls to try and sell you the insurance, that must be the most dispiriting and terrible job in the world, because a large proportion, I'm sure, of the people who pick up the phone will actually say no thank you instantly in mid-sentence or just put the phone down. It must be very dispiriting to do. That doesn't mean it's any better than we've said it is.
I've been into a call center, Andy, of a debt collection agency. Those guys are extraordinary human beings having to make those calls. I mean, you know, everyone needs a job, and not everybody's first choice of job would be in a debt collection call center. But the level of patience and the level of empathy that I saw being exercised on that particular day by those particular people, I don't know if they were on their best behavior because they had an observer in the room, was quite extraordinary. I mean, it's a terrible job. And the people that you should be shouting at when you're getting these calls that you don't want is the bosses. Target your anger at the boss's.
I suppose if you're on the receiving end of a debt collection call, you're well aware that the next thing they're going to try involves a baseball bat, so you might be...
No, Andy, that doesn't happen like that anymore. Does it? I mean, you may know. I wondered why you had a limp the other day. Andy Rice, branding advertising expert and quick mover. Andy Rice this evening on The Money Show. But yes, Andy Rice. Some interesting points being made this evening. Pick and Pay getting mocked by Nando's for Nkuku. And Checkers amending their advertising. Andy thinks it was him who got them to amend it. It doesn't matter. They're doing it better now. Union Billiards doing a good job with in Andy's view of printing advertising onto the 50,000 some of the 50,000 pool tables that are littered around South Africa. There's a good idea there, but unsolicited mobile phone calls, people are still using telemarketing, particularly the ones with the recorded sales pitches that just drive you absolutely over the edge.
The Africa Business Report.
The Africa Business Report, brought to you by Sanlam. Sanlam, investing in Africa, 33 countries and counting. The author of Africa's Billionaires, the head of programming at CNBC Africa, Chris Bishop. This free trade agreement, this continental free trade area, Chris Bishop, it's signed. All the work is done. We can now sit back and relax, and growth will follow, or not.
Well, not really. There's a lot more work to be done, a lot more paperwork. I mean, I was talking to the African Union last week at the World Economic Forum in Cape Town, and there's a lot of things that have to be drawn up, like, for instance, anti-dumping legislation. I mean, a lot of those smaller countries are worried that this free trade area means that, like, China and all the big powers out there can load their goods into the free trade area at one end, but they end up being dumped in some of the smaller, weaker markets, killing off industry as it goes. That's got to be sorted out. Transport infrastructure has got to be worked out as well, because it's also one of the experts I spoke to last week, he was saying that most countries in Africa, because of the colonial past, always have railway lines from the mines to the ports to the sea for export. But there's not enough lines going up and down the continent in between African countries to facilitate this trade. In fact, that's Mr. Kenyako, our friend, the Reserve Bank governor. He said that some countries even have different railway gauges, so that one train can't straight into another country very easily. And last but not least, the clearinghouse for payments has been worked out. But again, I hate to invoke Mr. Kenyako again. I mean, he reckons that the sort of payment settlement operations they have in SADC, East Africa and West Africa, that are dealing with regional payment now, could actually link up and start dealing with continent-wide trade as well. But it's certainly an interesting time. It promises a lot, but the other thing, it could take freaking decades to turn around. And, we're talking about last week, it took Europe more than half a century to get to a trading bloc, which is now crumbling a little bit, as you know. But it could take quite a few more years yet of hard work before it actually gets going.
It's all well and good to pop the champagne corks at the time of the signing, but the signing is only the first step to a huge project that has to still be done, of course. Xenophobia and xenophobic attacks. I mean, just what's your sense of the response of other African countries to the violence that we saw play out on our streets last week? And, simply this level of violence against foreigners in South Africa, the frequency does seem to be increasing. We've got some very angry neighbours, Mr. Bishop.
Well, that's the point. That's another thing that came out last week. I was with some of my colleagues from CNBC Africa from Lagos who were down covering West with me, and we were talking about it, and they were saying that there's a lot of anger in Nigeria. People think they're being picked on, in particular, the people saying, I mean, there's even talk that Nigeria is going to send a plane to fly people home. There was a lot of noise on social media about this thing. And there was a lot of feeling. I mean, my colleague, he said, well, yeah, all right, well, not every country is perfect, but most of the people from my country I know here, they're doing legitimate business, just working, or they've got corporate posts doing nobody any harm, and all of a sudden they're feeling unsafe. I think there's a lot of fear, and I think there's
it's getting quite serious, I think. But the whole point is that at least this country's trying to do something about it and trying to get the law enforcement agencies to guard against criminality and attacks, which is a good sign. And we spoke to Melody Pandor as well, and she was saying that, well, you know, we must try to embrace everybody from every nation on the continent, and we're all one. So it was quite an interesting time.
Yeah, it most certainly was. Tell me then about Kenya Airways. I mean, Kenya Airways at one time was literally the high flyer. They've lost some of their luster on the African continent to Ethiopian Airways, and they've gone through financial crises of their own. But they do have some big operational constraints.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of flights. I think something like 91 flights in recent weeks that have been cancelled because we've got a shortage of pilots. It's and I'm told it's from we've done stories before on these on the airlines on the continent. They're not the only ones who are struggling. Obviously, there's a problem with salaries. Obviously, there's a problem as well, you know, getting enough young trained pilots who are prepared to do a 20-30 year career in the sky, which is the ideal for most airlines. But certainly, Kenya seems to be struggling. They've got fewer pilots than they need to break even point to say. And so, therefore, sadly, quite a few flights are being cancelled. But it's a terrible shame, and one would think there would be an opportunity for some entrepreneur somewhere to set up a flying school or set up an agency to look for pilots around the world that can attempt to shore up the airlines of Africa.
I think if we ask most people about the idea of doing business in Angola, many people would balk at the idea. We've seen so many South African companies come quite unstuck in Angola, issues with payments. ShopRite more recently reported just how difficult that economy has been to do business in. But they have got interesting ties with Brazil, and I suppose it's the origins of Portuguese colonialism, perhaps, there's a tie that binds.
Well, also, there's a bigger tie that binds. There's a cable under the sea. Between Brazil and Angola. It was finished last year. It's more than 6,000 kilometers long, which is a heck of a way, as you know. And this is one of my favorite interviews that I did at the World Economic Forum. I interviewed a guy called Antonio Nunes. He's works at Angola Cables. And the thing I liked about it was it brought this fourth industrial revolution thing, which everyone keeps spouting every 5 minutes everywhere you look. At the World Economic Forum, it brings you into focus actually what can be doing. And so what's happening, you said they've got farmers growing farms in Angola, farmers based in Brazil, and what they're doing, because it's undersea cable now, they're managing their irrigation systems in Angola from Brazil because they've got this massive undersea cable. And the added rider to that I thought was wonderful was the fact that first time I went to Angola in 1994, the country was ravaged by war, destroyed absolutely. I've never seen a place more devastated than I saw it in 1994. And here you are, 25 years later, there's people running irrigation systems under sea cable. So it was a story that cheered me somewhat.
As it should. Chris Bishop, thank you. The author of Africa's Billionaires, the head of programming at CNBC Africa with our Africa Business Report this evening. Thank you, Chris Bishop. South African liquor business. I mean, SAB Miller, of course, South Africa's greatest liquor export in history. It was an extraordinary success story of a couple of people from number 2 Jan Smuts Avenue along and across the road from Wits University who, when apartheid was in its death throes, decided that they could start expanding the business of SAB. And they moved up through the African continent and started buying up breweries across Africa. And then as the Berlin Wall came crashing down, saw the opportunity that other international brewers saw in Eastern Europe, and they started buying breweries there. Eventually, I think it was 1999, they listed in London to raise capital and bought Miller in the United States and therefore became SAB Miller. And over time, became, for a while, I think it was a couple of months, where they were the world's biggest brewer before AB then bought InBev. And ultimately, a couple of years ago, SAB Miller tried to buy Heineken from the family that owns it, and they managed to block the deal, and it then became inevitable. Only a question of time that SAB would be taken over by AB InBev. And to all intents and purposes, the name of SAB Miller is in the history books. Now, AB InBev produces Castle Lager alongside Budweiser and Stella Artois and other beers. So really, it's up to Richard Rushton to fly the South African booze flag. No pressure at all. He is the chief executive of Distell. What, the biggest booze producer in South Africa? You must be. I mean, a South African booze producer, other than these foreign types.
Yeah, that's probably right. We are.
But an interesting array as well. I mean, the wine spirits category is where you dominate. But it's interesting to see how beer consumption worldwide, I think peak beer consumption was reached in 2007. And ever since then, companies like yourself all over the world have actually been eroding the beer market and have been growing the categories, particularly the spirits category.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I think beer consumption has fallen a little. Growth is flat, particularly mainstream beer across the world. The growth that's there to be had is in the premium space for beer. But where there is growth in alcoholic beverages, it's across spirits, particularly wines, and then premium products like ciders are ready to drink. So they've all done pretty well.
Tell me about liquor consumption. How much money do we as South Africans spend a year? You must have some research in terms of the amount of money we spend pouring stuff down our throats.
Well, I don't have the exact number as a percentage of our disposable income, but I can tell you that our consumption is over 250 billion litres of alcohol, million litres of absolute alcohol. That's a lot. 55% of that alcohol is beer, about 17% wine. That's relatively small given the fact that we have got a long
standing. We're a big producer.
Yeah, we're a big producer. And then the rest is sort of ready to drinks and spirits. I think our consumption has fallen off. Obviously, economic times also affect the consumption habit, but also tax and the relative price has gone up quite a lot in South Africa. So I'd say that we're one of the larger consumers, not the largest by any standards in emerging markets, but growth has certainly flattened. And
I mean, your last set of results, you were talking about the fact that South Africa is actually going backwards and you were quite heavily dependent on your rest of Africa business for growth.
Yeah, so Bruce, for us, volumes were flat and our business is 73% of our business is still South Africa in revenue terms. So we're still small by global standards, and you know, we reflected 40% revenue growth in Africa outside of the customs union, and we're pretty proud of that.
But these also you put into economies like Ghana, which is growing at 5 or 6%.
Correct.
You're going into other countries where growth rates are considerably higher, and as growth rates expand and people get jobs and people's aspirations grow and change, they look for brands, and you provide brands into those markets, particularly if they're underserved by other brands. You get to build a presence.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, East Africa's a vibrant place to be doing business in. I was in Kenya last week, and you've got an economy growing between 5.5% and 6% there. And as you say, with growing levels of urbanization, more females coming into working populations in Africa, we're seeing growth, you know, starting to emerge for wines, spirits, and other products beyond beer. And that's exciting for us as a company.
Are you playing in the beer market at all?
We have a little stake in a Durban Poison, a small premium beer here in South Africa.
Okay, so that's the one that's got a dakhalif on it. Yes.
There's a little bit in there.
And a little bit of an extract. Does it have an impact on your consumers?
No. I mean,
it's a marketing and branding exercise.
Yeah, and it's a pretty good premium beer, I must tell you. And, you know, I mean, for us, we historically have stayed out of beer.
That was an SAB conflict, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, largely. I mean, we were in beer. Historically, the Rembrandt Group were in beer.
Kronenbräu, 1308, the cart horses and the wagons and the barrels. Yes, I remember those. Every small town show had the horses and the barrels come and show up. But eventually, I mean, even the Rupert's got beaten by SAB. They had to capitulate.
Well, I think for us, you know, what we've seen in the last 15 years is a massive growth of cider. And as you've seen more females enter that occasion with male beer drinkers, so you've seen much more mixed gender drinking, and ciders, of course, have played
And you dominate the market. I mean, Hunter's, I think, is probably bigger than Savannah.
Yeah. I mean, both brands are pretty much almost the same size now.
And they must they must have, what, 70, 80% market share at least?
Yeah, I would think they're pretty dominant players. And, we benefited from choice, actually, and from good marketing, good premium marketing. And as a result of that, it was quite a strong decade of growth, which actually changed Distell quite profoundly, because we were historically a brandy and a wine business. Mm. So it changed the very fabric of the company.
What percentage of your sales then are ciders?
Well, I think you've got to look at revenue more than litres because of 13% wine and 4-5% cider. So it's about 37% of our revenue.
What?
But yeah, so it's pretty
cider.
Big. Yeah.
Savannah and Hunter's is 37%.
We've got a few other beautiful brands. One of them you might know called Bernini. So these are all growing quite quickly. So
these are all mass industrial sort of production, though. I mean, there's quite an exciting market, but I think it's quite it sort of chops and changes a lot, because I think it's very hard to break into the craft cider market. We've seen Scully come to the market.
Yeah.
We've seen Kluver and Jack come. I don't know if it's still on the market.
Yeah, they're still there.
There's some small players who are coming in the craft cider space, which is, again, an exciting addition to a category. And if you believe in Kevin Hedewick's theory that, you know, there's no competition, it's just everyone is expanding a category, that's good for the market, surely.
No, it is good. I mean, I ascribe to that. I think it's great that we have these craft ciders. It opens up for us to further consumers. And, you know, we're pretty confident that our brands are well positioned. And Savannah has kind of got a quirky...
Occasionally you'll see imports. I mean, Bulmers will occasionally come in. You'll occasionally see some Strongbow come in, Irish and English ciders coming in.
Well, traditionally, ciders came out of the UK. Yeah. That's where it started.
It's rotten apple juice. It's rotten appetizer. It's delicious, but it's appetizer with a kick. Tell me, please, because I hear a story, and it is a story which I'd like you to verify for me this evening, that about 15% of every Savannah is Chinese apples.
I wouldn't know if it was 15%, but I'll tell you this. We buy about 35 million liters of apple juice concentrate a year.
From China?
No. About 4 years ago, probably 65% of our apple juice concentrate came out of imports, so effectively China, and some of it out of Poland, primarily out of China, and the rest out of South Africa. And, of course, you know, I think for us as a country, we've got to create jobs, and jobs in the agricultural sector. So we've been working away furiously at trying to switch the imported ratio of apple juice concentrate to local, and at the same time look for opportunities to get black farmers into the sector, because it's been historically in the hands of white farmers. So,
but traditionally apples are grown in Elgin.
And it's
quite a small geographic area where apples are grown. So
that's
do
right.
you just intensify it? Do you expand the growing areas? I mean, how do you do this?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you need... As you rightly say, you know, the apple juice concentrate comes from those grade apples that are not exported. So typically we rely then on those apples. They largely come out of Elgin. We need a specification of those apples. But as we start exploring opportunities, for example, closer to Lesotho, Limpopo, those climatic areas, you know, there may be opportunities to start to open up apple orchards elsewhere in the country. They do primarily, though, they're here in the Western
Cape. And the varietals? I mean, is it particular varietals, or can you ciderify an apple no matter where it comes from?
Yeah, but I that's one of the – I mean, this is a pretty new category. So one of the exciting things that our sort of R&D people are doing are exploring – how you could potentially use different types of apples to create different flavor and profiles.
Talk to the guys at Scully. They've got a golden delicious, and they've got a crisp apple. And not that I'm addicted, but it's you know, one sees the flavor profiles that do come through. But there's an opportunity there. I mean, the same way as the Sundays River Valley near Port Elizabeth has become citrus central for massive export. We've seen huge opportunities in the blueberry industry from Tilbach and that part of the world. We've seen big export opportunities there for local consumption. We could see an apple industry develop. But if you plant an apple seed today, it take what must take 5 or 6 years at
longer,
least until,
little, yeah.
until production
yeah.
happens.
A little longer. And then you need about 6 to 8 tons of apples for every ton of apple juice concentrates, you know, that you need to ferment. And
is it worth it? I mean, from purely on a commercial basis, it's not cheaper just to import the stuff and use other people's apples.
Well, you know, I think obviously our pricing, obviously because we're local, transport and tax is a significant feature of that commodity, so we'd like to reduce that. So, and we're more or less at import parity now.
Okay.
So actually there's quite a nice profitable opportunity for farming and apples in this country.
Okay, but we've just got to find regions to do it because the hills are full of apple trees.
Yeah. Right?
Richard Rushton is the chief executive of Distell. More with him in a moment.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
1970s, there wasn't a dinner table without a Niederberg Baron or an Edelrit. And your focus has changed, I suspect, because those were the premium brands of their day. There were like five wine producers. The priorities, I think, of Distell have changed in terms of where the focus is in terms of wine. Because I'm not, if that's what they tasted like in the 70s, they weren't really that premium.
Well, look, they're beautiful brands.
They're great brands.
And appeal to a slightly different consumer set. But I think, yeah, obviously with the growth of cider, with our expansion geographically, we acquired Bern Stewart, a single malt business, a spirits business in Scotland. Our focus did start to change. Having said that, I mean, wine is an important, almost a third, of just under a third by revenue of our business.
But so I can't think the brands that have fallen under you. Well, I mean, because I see on your website, Alice Fleuren, I thought that was still in the Milan family. But this is a Milan winemaker there.
Yeah, so very much in the Milan family, but part of our family. So
okay.
So
Alice Fleuren, Alto's in there, Zonnebloem is in there, Durbanville Hills is in there, Fleur de Cup is in there, Niederberg is in there, Old Brown Sherry is in there as well.
That's right, Tassenberg.
Tassenberg.
Chateau Libertas.
Tell us about Tassenberg. Now, where did the grapes come from for Tassenberg? Because, I mean, the rumor throughout history has been these Argentinian Cinso grapes and...
Well, actually...
You'll put hair in your chest.
In the times that perhaps I, as a student, consumed Tassenberg, it was partially Cabernet Sauvignon and a lot of Cinso. That blend has changed somewhat. I mean, I think we'd like to see a little bit more Cinso back in to Tassenberg, but Chateau as well also had a good dose of Cab Sav. Yeah,
I found a 20-year-old bottle of Tassenberg Reserve, which I had in a cupboard somewhere. And unfortunately, it's been leaking. I hate to think what's happened to it over 20 years. But there was at one point, you were putting a cork into a Tassenberg to try and premiumize it.
That's right. But, I mean, wine is an incredibly important part of our business. I mean, we buy about a third of South Africa's grape and wine to either... meet local demand or export.
What is your biggest export brand that you as Distell?
Depends by value or volume. I mean, Niederberg is still our biggest.
But you premiumize that category as well. I mean, there's Niederberg and then there's Niederberg.
It would be fair to say that we've got some work to do there. I mean, we've created in the last year a separate business, a smaller entrepreneurial business called Libertas Vineyards and Estates.
I saw that, yeah.
And the purpose is to put those brands in that entrepreneurial business unit and then just treat them with love and care and passion and the dedication that small premium brands need. And
there's good heritage in those brands.
Yeah, they're beautiful brands. And I think, you know, the little bit that I know about these categories is they go through cycles. Sometimes they skip generations and come back strong. And who knows, you might see... That happened for things like Chateau Libertas.
Well, we live in hope. I mean, Chateau Libertas has its place. It definitely has its place. Amarula has been one of the most extraordinary exports out of South Africa.
Beautiful brand. That the story of Amarula, outside of it being just a great brand discovery and something that's uniquely South African, is also linked to people. So the marula fruit is grown in the northern parts of our country. It helps lots of our African women who actually gather the marula fruit. We pick
it's
that
still done old school, is it?
So it's still done old school. We pick the fruit up, we ferment it, we turn it into a spirit. The tassels that go on the bottle are made by a small female black economic empowerment group in Somerset West. They make the tassels for us. And then, you know, as you know, elephants consume the fruit. And, you know, we've got a passion for conserving those beautiful animals. And that's part of our unique kind of Amarula story, this Amarula African beautiful cream.
And it's a massive export as well.
Yeah, so about half of our, it's one of our brands. It's over R1 billion by revenue. And it's available in 80 countries, and about half of the revenue comes outside of South Africa. So it's if you were kind of to define a global brand, that would be...
Is that the most global of your
brands?
Yeah,
that's probably the most global of our brands. And, of course, it plays a unique role, you know, in the occasion, in the social occasion. And, I mean, we're starting to innovate and do interesting things with flavors and a new one called Vanilla Spice, and we've got an exciting array of new ones to come. So... And but I think you've got to do that in today's world.
At your core, though, Van Rains and Klipdrift and Richelieu, the age-old French tradition. I think there was the payoff line when they were allowed to advertise. Yeah, yeah. And again, this is a category where you are sitting on probably millions of liters of this stuff, quietly mellowing and aging in vats underneath your head office.
Yeah, that's... Quite correct. I mean, the brandy category is just core to us. It's who, you know, it represents so much of the fabric of our history. I mean, a little fact that I don't think people know is that, for example, more than half of the regular consumption of Klipdrift is actually young black urban males. So it's a market that's
but the demographic of that market, because, I mean, you think of Clippies, and it's, yeah, it's burly Afrikaans.
Yes, you'd think with about
shirts, with shirts that don't quite cover the belly button, and with a short pant that doesn't quite meet the shirt anymore. And that's the demographic it did appeal to.
Yeah, yes. We love those consumers, but we're excited about the other, you know, the opening world of consumption for us with our black urban consumers.
Now, the rage to drink, we had a very angry man on social media earlier today saying, I hear you're going to interview Distell's chief executive this evening. Ask him why Clippies and Cola contains no brandy, please. These ready-to-make drinks are a scam. He's very, very cross.
Okay, well, yeah, just to say that 30% of the spirit that goes into Clippies and Cola is actually Klipdrift, three-year-old pot still brandy.
Is that the stuff that goes into the bottle?
That's what goes into the bottle. And then the remaining 70% is cane spirit. And the only reason we do that is simply because we want to make that brand as accessible as possible in price terms, but also still keep it uniquely Klipdrift, a brandy. But we can't call it brandy, so we call it Clippies and Cola. So,
But it's not the same experience as taking the bottle of Clippies and taking a bottle of your favorite cola, whether it be a Pepsi or Coke or a no-name brand, and hoying them together at home. It's a different proposition.
That's exactly right. I mean, to my friends in Pretoria who love brandy and Coke, I'd say enjoy it that way. For me, putting it on one block of ice is just without Coke is actually fantastic.
What about your foreign brands? Because you mean Buna Havin,
yeah,
which is the most unpronounceable brand in the world. That's why you got to buy it. And you got a couple of others as well. Are you still looking at globalizing the Distell business? Because I got a sense that there was big ambition and then it was like, oh, and actually, no, hold on. Let's focus on the homegrown brands.
Yeah. So, firstly, those businesses are growing strongly. So, those single malts are growing by in excess of 20% by revenue, and they're playing to a consumer trend where, you know, Tobermory, Bunahaven, these are destination places, consumers looking for experiences, the person behind the brand, etc. So they're doing pretty well. But the truth is, you know, we focused on Africa. I mean, we think there's a massive runway of growth for us on the African continent, and we're investing people, time, our brand effort in the African on the African continent.
Can Andy Watts's Baines fight a fair fight in the 8, 12, 15, 18-year-old categories? I saw it launched some 18-year-olds today.
Yeah, we're pretty convinced. I mean, we understand that this is a long game, but the beauty, the differentiation, the story behind Baines, I don't think is any different from the one that we created 40, 50 years ago with Amarula. So,
is Amarula that old?
Yeah, it's a beautiful old brand in the 70s. So,
Oh my goodness me. Time is moving on. Richard Rushton, Chief Executive of Distell, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.